Paul joined CDC in 1986 and has been involved in many projects in the area of vaccine-preventable diseases. His expertise is in measles molecular epidemiology, and Paul developed the framework for the designation of measles genotypes, has been drafting protocols for measles RT-PCR and genetic analysis, and he's going to be talking to us about laboratory methods to support measles control programs. Paul.
Thanks, Mark. Good afternoon, everybody. And I wanted to give you just an update on the molecular surveillance for measles viruses. These are the four points I wanted to cover today. First, I wanted to go over the lessons learned after 20 years of studies on the molecular epidemiology of measles virus. Having been in this for a while, I often got questions from people at the World Health Organization and other state departments about why we go through all the trouble to get viral isolates and do all of this sequencing and everything else when we can just draw a serum and do an IgM. I don't get those kind of questions anymore, and I think we've shown the utility of this kind of analysis, and I'd like to go through that information with you very quickly. I'll briefly summarize the measles genotypes and cases that were from the U.S. in 2008. You've already heard a couple other presentations at this session and the session before this about measles outbreaks in the U.S. that have nicely covered the epidemiology. And then I want to talk about a few things that we can do maybe to improve the quality of virologic surveillance. And my goal is really to emphasize the importance of virologic surveillance, especially for measles, but also to remind you that it's also a critical aspect of laboratory surveillance for some of the other vaccine-preventable diseases, for example, the ones that we work in my group at CDC, which would be mumps, rubella, and varicella zoster virus. Lesson one, and actually I got these lessons are these slides were all made by Jenny, so she can take credit for the lessons learned. And the first is that molecular techniques must be used in conjunction with standard epidemiologic techniques, and that goes without saying, that we have to have the combination of good case tracing and a good laboratory to really fully understand these outbreaks. Obviously, the techniques allow us to monitor transmission of measles viruses during and after outbreaks and to either confirm suggested epidemiologic links, or sometimes when those links are unknown, they can actually suggest epidemiologic links. Certainly has the power to differentiate between ongoing transmission of an endemic virus from a new imported source of virus. And this is a critical criterion for certification or validation of elimination from a given country. And so many of the regions in the world now are moving toward very near-term elimination goals, and part of those goals include certain criteria that they want to meet in terms of virologic surveillance. They are going to have to demonstrate the absence of an endemic genotype in country X. And we're working with the Pan American Health Organization and most of the other groups in WHO that have elimination targets to kind of finalize these lab arguments there. And the data, of course, for this came from the work that was done in the U.S. in the late part of the 1990s and up in 2000, where we could demonstrate part of the evidence to show that the U.S. had eliminated measles was the molecular surveillance. The other thing that we know now is that we must be able to compare the sequence information in addition to the genotype. So we made a genotyping scheme 10 years ago that worked out pretty well for the time. But we found out that we can actually slice this up a little bit finer, and we can actually look at the actual sequence of the virus. And so there are actually multiple distinct genetic lineages within each genotype, and I'll show you some examples a little later on. And we know now from looking at a lot of outbreaks and a lot of samples that sequences of viruses from a single chain of transmission are identical or nearly identical. I know nearly identical is kind of an oxymoron, but they're actually identical. I think the nucleotide changes we see are more sequence artifacts than anything else. So we can tell now whether a virus is in a single chain of transmission. What we can't differentiate from is whether we're having a single chain of transmission or multiple importations from the same source. And this is the problem that we had, especially last year, because we had a lot of importations from the same source, notably the big outbreaks in Europe. This is a no-brainer here. Of course, if there are outbreaks anywhere, there are potential for outbreaks everywhere. And we've been able to track the rapid global travel of measles lineages. You've heard a lot about the D5s coming from Switzerland and Japan, but just to remind you, a few years ago, we tracked the genotype B3 from Kenya and Somalia through Europe, through Newark Airport and into Mexico and beyond. And a lot of those associations were made by molecular epidemiology. So some of those connections weren't apparent until we actually had the sequence of the virus. And this is the global airline transmission. These are all of the flights that go. And you can see most of them are coming to see Chris Zimmerman in Brooklyn here. I'm glad you guys are ready. But it just shows you how fast a virus can get on a plane with its associated host and move from coast to coast or country to country or continent to continent. You notice the Americas are off this because we have eliminated endemic measles from the Americas, and this is just an outline of the different genotypes and where we think they're endemic now. Don't pay too much attention to Europe because it changes almost every year. but the rest of these are pretty stable. So this is how we would be able to trace a foreign source of a virus. And you can see there's some geographic restriction for the genotype. So the B2 and B3 are mostly northern and central Africa. We have H1 in China and a range of different genotypes in India and things like that. So we have a pretty good handle now on what the endemic strains are in most countries of the world. All of the countries that are shaded in gray have had some baseline surveillance, and you see that we've got a pretty good coverage. You know, five years ago, most of this map had white, and there was just very few gray countries. So this is a real tribute to the work done by the WHO Global Laboratory Network to increase viral surveillance in all of the labs. And just to remind you, WHO has 180 labs in all the different countries that are doing measles and rubella surveillance, and part of their job is to try to get strains for isolation and genotyping, and that's what's been responsible for being able to fill in this map so completely. Lesson four, transmission can occur anywhere, and amusement parks, airports, hospitals, things like that, physicians' offices, and we even saw in the B3 outbreak in the customs line at Newark Airport. This is the outbreak from the Little League World Series, and I believe case four was an INS agent in Detroit who had just stamped the passport of the Japanese baseball player who was arriving and became exposed. And so it's pretty amazing how these things can go. And we had spread here to college students as far away as Texas, and a few spread cases in Michigan. From someone sitting on the plane next to somebody. So the transmission patterns are not always apparent, so you have to kind of expect the unexpected, that even somebody probably changing planes in a big airport like JFK or LAX could infect somebody else. Another lesson is that we know after all the measles vaccines are in genotype A, despite that the vaccines have been globally effective despite different endemic genotypes. So we know that the vaccines, which are genotype A, work just as well in China as they do in Africa, as they do in Asia, if they're properly administered and they have good potency and there's good cold chain and things like that. And when necessary, vaccine reactions can be confirmed by genetic characterization of the virus. So we can look at the sequence of the virus and show that it's genotype A and clearly identify a vaccine reaction. If we can get sufficient material to amplify. And this became a pretty big issue during the recent outbreaks in 2008, because we had people who were vaccinated and exposed, and then if they developed rash a few days later, the only way we could really tell that it was a vaccine reaction or a natural disease was to isolate the virus and confirm that it was a vaccine reaction. Viral surveillance in the USA, so we had about 140 cases and six outbreaks. We got genotype information from six of the six outbreaks and seven of the sporadic cases, and this is just a line listing of those, and you can see the different states. They're in chronologic order from top to bottom. And the main sources of virus in 2008 were primarily the big outbreaks in Europe, Switzerland, Israel, and Italy, as well as a little bit from Asian countries. We had the usual one or two cases from China and Pakistan, and a few cases, and at least maybe one sort of from Japan, but after hearing Kaz's talk, I'm not quite sure about that. I have to show a phylogenetic tree, sorry about that. But this is how the computer looks at these sequences. And the interesting thing about this, these are the vaccine sequences, they're clearly A, H1s are from China. But if you look at these vertical lines indicate sequence identity. And so what we were picking up from all these different imports were these are the two main lineages that were circulating in Europe in 2007 to 2008 and are still going. And you can see they're virtually identical, both from the D4, which was spread, actually started in the UK, spread to Belgium, and then on to Israel, and at various points was spread back to the US. And the D5s either came from Switzerland or Japan, and you can see that the Swiss and the Japanese strains are indistinguishable by sequence. So this is one of the limitations, is that we can't really, when we have viruses that are this close, we can't really differentiate too much for the source. We're looking at different sequencing windows, and I think we can now tell the Japanese version of the D5s from the Swiss version of the D5s, and I'll save that data for maybe the next immunization conference. But you can see how like I said previously, that within one chain of transmission, we expect very little sequence divergence, and these are all identical. So it shows that there's conditions in these European countries, especially, where a single lineage of virus can go through, and it finds a sufficient number of susceptibles that it can just keep one lineage and one chain of transmission going for quite some time. And then with the concomitant export of viruses into the United States. And this pattern is repeated in other countries, including Canada and some countries in South America too, so we're not the only ones detecting these viruses. This is just a blow up of some of the D4 viruses, and you can see this is sort of the European version of D4. Actually, it even has a name now. It's called the Enfield lineage because it's been going so long we had to name it. So this is the Enfield lineage. It started in Enfield, England, but made its way around Europe. And you can see it's clearly distinct. This is a important to Georgia from Pakistan. Again, this is all one genotype, and they would both be listed as D4, but you can see it's clearly distinct on the sequence, so we can tell for sure that this is a different source of virus. And this gives us so different sequences or different genotypes will suggest multiple chains of transmission, and it allows us to at least say that the sources for these are different, and it wasn't prolonged spread of these New York cases that might have come to Georgia. What can we do to improve virologic surveillance? I think we certainly need to stay vigilant about collecting samples for viral detection, either a throat swab, nasal pharyngeal aspirate, urine sample, from as many suspected cases as possible. And the goal would be to obtain genetic information from every chain of transmission and sporadic case. So anytime we have a real measles case, it would be nice to be able to get this kind of information on it. I know, especially for sporadic cases, I know it's very, very difficult, because by the time you know about the case, it's usually too late. Also, the detection of viral RNA by real-time RT-PCR or isolation of the virus in cell culture has an expanding role in diagnosis. And we have seen especially a small number of cases in people who have been previously vaccinated who have less severe disease and often don't make an IgM response. And some of those cases we've been able to confirm by either PCR or virus isolation. It's particularly true. One of the cases from Texas, one of the students had two doses of MMR and had, I believe, flu-like illness, was IgM negative for measles, but was PCR positive and isolation positive. So these virologic sample specimens give us another fallback sample to look at in case the IgM results are not able to fully classify the case. And even just to emphasize the role of virus isolation, we've had very few samples that have been positive by virus isolation but negative for some reason by PCR. Maybe they had some inhibitors or something like that. Sequence analysis is still the only way to distinguish between a vaccine reaction and a natural infection, and so we need respiratory samples for that. And my colleagues in Europe have been using oral fluid surveillance for quite some time, and particularly the UK does all of its surveillance by oral fluid. The data that they've shown suggests that using oral fluid as your sample might expand might allow for detection of viral samples for a longer period after the onset of rash. So normally we think about throat swabs and NP aspirates being positive until about 5 to 7 days after rash onset. They have some data that shows with the oral fluid that they can get positive reactions, not all of them, but maybe in 30% of the cases up to about day 14. So there might be the possibility to extend that, and it might be worthwhile to consider a study to compare side by side oral fluid versus the standard throat swabs or nasal pharyngeal aspirates for sensitivity and see how it works in the setting in the United States. Oral fluid, again, is fairly easy to collect. You just use one of these handy sponge on a stick devices. Another thing we can do to expand virologic surveillance would be to expand the state lab capacity for virus isolation. Currently, the WHO now recommends a single cell line, which is called VeroSLAM, for isolation of measles and rubella virus. It's a standard cell line that's been genetically engineered to express the receptor, which is called SLAM, signaling leukocyte activation marker, for wild-type measles virus. The advantage to this cell line is that it has the same efficiency as the B95A cells, which were the previously preferred cell line. But the advantage to the VeroSLAM cells is that because they're derived on of a VeroCell background, they don't secrete Epstein-Barr virus like the B95A, so they're much safer to handle in the lab, and they are a little bit easier to work with. They're more of a standard cell line. CDC has protocols that we can provide, and Dr. Yanagi in Japan, who developed the cell line, has agreed to let us transfer this to state labs under his MTA for purposes of diagnostics without any cost. So he's been very nice about allowing us to distribute the cell line, and we've sent it to most of the labs in the WHO lab network throughout the world. But it would be available I know some of the states do a fair amount of virus isolation and send us isolates for characterization. I would recommend if you are doing that, you might want to switch away from the B95As and consider working with this cell line. And then finally, we need timely and efficient reporting of sequence information. So we need this on a global scale, because the viruses can, as I showed and as you all know, can travel very quickly from country to country. And so the best way we have of tracking these lineages is to be able to analyze our sequence data very quickly with a global database. To that attempt, CDC has validated all of the historic sequence information from GeneBank. We've put it onto a huge database. And we're developing new databases to facilitate rapid exchange of sequence information, not just within the US, but throughout the world. So we have a CDC database that's hooked up to a WHO database, which is also, we're sharing information. The mouse just died again. Oh, here we go. With the Health Protection Agency in London, and trying to develop a one single database where people can send their sequence and it'll do a search and come up with the nearest match. Just to show you, this is the number of sequences we've been able to obtain, and so you can see the tremendous increase in the number of sequences in the last few years, mostly since the WHO lab network has gotten going. And WHO now has 5,000 sequences on their database. So our plan, this is the HPA website. It's called MEANS, Measles Nucleotide Sequence Database. The advantage to this site is a user-friendly website, and one could actually upload your sequence and it'll do a real-time search on this site and give you the closest match to whatever sequence you have. And so we're trying to, CDC worked with the HPA extensively last year to debug this website and to test things, and we're hoping that this will become kind of the universal sequence database for measles. And I'd just like to end right there and thank everybody, especially at the lab branch at CDC. We work very closely, of course, with the Global Immunization Division at CDC for international measles, and our epidemiology branch at CDC for the domestic surveillance. Sorry I didn't put everybody's name down, but it would have taken up quite a bit of slides, and I certainly would have forgotten somebody who's probably sitting right there, so I just decided not to do it. Again, a lot of we work very closely also with our main partner, which is the World Health Organization, and its establishment of networks, as regional labs and national labs. And of course, we always are grateful for the support and the collaboration of the state and local public health labs throughout the U.S. Thanks.
Quick comment. I'm Dan Hoffensberger from the Wisconsin Immunization Program. Quick comment on the first presentation. Our measles outbreak started on a Friday afternoon as well, and it's interesting people outside of public health don't understand the significance. But my main reason for coming up is to publicly thank Paul and Jennifer and the others at the state at the CDC lab. The ability to do the genotyping was extremely helpful for us. We had measles and rubella running concurrently. But especially it was helpful when you weren't able to necessarily track as to whether it was an imported case or not. We had a couple situations like that. It was especially helpful with the kids who, as you mentioned, with the the individuals who had been previously or recently immunized to be able to prove, because we had a number of those that had rash fever illness, so that was very helpful. But I also wanted to thank you for your patience, because we had a couple situations where the initial blood tests didn't match up with the symptoms, and you stuck with us and continuing to run further tests to prove that it wasn't measles. So a big thank you to you and your all your colleagues, because it was very helpful for all the work you helped us, all the things you helped us with. So thanks.
Any other questions? Paul, if states wanted to try doing the oral fluid testing, would CDC be able to provide the equipment and shipping for that?
Yeah, the collection kits are made by a company, Malvern Diagnostics in England. If someone wanted to try to collect some oral fluids, we could send the collection devices out. They're a little bit on the expensive side, so I don't really have enough to pre-position them in every state, but if somebody wanted to try some in response to a small outbreak, we'd be able to get them there by FedEx, and then they can be shipped back on wet ice just like the rest of the virologic samples.
Thank you.
And I'm sure Jenny will help you coordinate that, so just give her a call. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Paul.